Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have a very special guest in store for you today and a very special focus. We're going to talk about psychiatry from the standpoint of integrative medicine and natural non-pharmacological approaches. We're also going to talk a little bit about women's health with an outstanding practitioner. She is Kelly Brogan, and she specializes in holistic women's health psychiatry, caring for the whole woman naturally. And her training is very, very rigorous in conventional medicine. She's a graduate of Cornell University Medical College here in New York City. She also took a little sideline trip to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I guess she's not too smart. She has a master's degree in brain and cognitive science. That's pretty cool. Also, she has training in endocrinology, in psychosomatic medicine. She is, of course, board certified in psychiatry, and she trained at precisely the institution that I trained at, NYU School of Medicine here in New York. She has an active practice. She is a big communicator. She has a fantastic website at kellybroganmd.com. Lots of resources there. So without further ado, Kelly, it's a pleasure having you as a guest here on Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
It's wonderful, wonderful to be here. Thanks so much.
So tell us a little bit about your journey. How did you get involved in an alternative approach to psychiatry?
So I sort of started out as a feminist and have been one probably since puberty. But I was most interested in women's health. That was my driving passion, I suppose. And I quickly learned, as you can potentially remember from medical school rotations, that obstetrics and gynecology was not the best way to care for women. That by the nature of the profession, it's so overwhelming, and these doctors just don't have the wherewithal, the tools, or the time to really be a whole woman provider.
So you got tired of C-sections and D&Cs and, all that stuff.
Right, and sort of like the embittered attitude that seemed to come with it. So I found out, I had a mentor up at Cornell, Catherine Berndorf, and she taught me about this new blossoming specialty called reproductive psychiatry or perinatal mental health. And I went on to, I always had that, my eye on that prize, going through a psychiatric residency, sort of extended torture session at Bellevue. And
wow, at Bellevue, that's, you're really the belly of the beast. I mean, that's probably the toughest exactly. Psychiatry rotation in the country because,
it's the real deal.
As I mean, the people in New York, as if they're not crazy enough, the ones right. That are really bad, they end up at Bellevue.
That's where they end up. When the president gets shot and when you have a psychotic episode, that's where you're going to end up.
Yep.
So it's, listen, it was what I needed to get under my belt to see what conventional psychiatry was all about at its most dramatic. And I began to specialize in treating pregnant women or women planning a pregnancy or women who were breastfeeding and postpartum. And I soon recognized the severe limitations of psychiatry in that model and how this dichotomy of taking meds or not taking meds was just too limited, sort of a menu for most women. And my training was really in how to medicate these women and how to protect their rights to medication treatment. So I would meet a woman who was on lithium, let's say, and I would help her understand the nature of what the literature showed about her risks if she were to continue taking medication during pregnancy. And then she would have to make the decision, of course, with my help about whether to continue it or whether just to stop it and wing it.
Right.
Yeah.
But, and clearly there are feminist implications to this because I read some really stark statistics that an incredible percentage of America's women, more so than men, are on psychiatric medication. So I guess the conclusion to be drawn is that either it's tough being a woman in America these days or else women are extraordinarily being coerced, pressured, convinced, cajoled into going on psych medications for various problems that perhaps may not even really require psychiatric medications.
That's exactly right. And that's sort of my mission at this point. So it's one in four women. It's a quarter of
one in four. Yeah, that's what I thought it was. Yeah,
reproductive age population. And so all of these women who are started on medications, you know, my sort of beef at this point is that nobody is sitting them down and having a frank discussion about what we do know about the potential risks, even if you perceive them to be rare, including the nature of the dependency that forms around taking these medications for more than a couple of months, including potential for erratic and violent behavior that can occur and has occurred in postpartum setting.
Let's pause there, because there have been some very lurid cases of women turning into stone cold killers and sometimes driving into lakes in one celebrated case with all the kids inside, or slicing and dicing their babies, drowning them. And you actually are privy to information that suggests that it may be not so much because they weren't medicated, but precisely because they were medicated that they became such monsters in terms of, their emotions were blunted and they managed to do these horrible acts.
Absolutely. And listen, I was trained to respond to this sort of a sensational claim with a lot of party line rhetoric, which is that, well, you know, they were inadequately treated, or certainly people who ultimately are going to act out in these abnormal ways are the ones who are most likely to be treated. So how can you point a finger?
Right.
But actually it's on the label in the medication in the prescription package that suggests that we know that antidepressants specifically as a class have a risk of agitation, mania, and provoking activation of the nervous system. And this is not such a broad, you know, a sort of shocking claim, because you're not actually sort of part of what I learned when I began to read the work of people who have questioned the paradigm is that, in fact, we're not correcting a deficiency as I had been trained to believe, right?
Right. So I mean, it's like we tend to look at this as, you know, like a vitamin D deficiency or a thyroid deficiency.
Exactly.
You know, we fill a gap with some of these medications. They're sort of hamburger helper for your neurotransmitters. That's the way that they're sold.
Yes. And really by pharmaceutical companies through direct-to-consumer advertising. I mean, you ask anyone on the street what causes depression, and they'll tell you the words serotonin, even if they've never had a chemistry class or biology class in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they have that information because advertisers are speaking to them through print and television. So we have this unique sort of echo chamber of this rhetoric that really has no grounding in evidence-based medicine. There's really not a human study, consistent human data to show that serotonin deficiency has anything to do with depression at all.
Well, look, just for the record, let me get this straight. A patient who comes to see you at your office in New York City who's suffering from a psychiatric problem, depression, anxiety, you know, bipolar disorder, you're not inalterably opposed to keeping them on medication or otherwise putting them on medication. You're just very, very conservative about it.
It may just be sort of part of where I'm at in my evolution, and maybe if you check in with me in 10 years, I'll have calmed down a bit. But actually, I haven't started someone on medication in 2 years.
Wow. Okay.
So I actually am opposed.
You're really a purist about using a natural approach. That's very interesting.
Yes. I will maintain patients, and, you know, I prescribed for many years before I had this sort of like aha experience. So I'm not, you know, speak with patients that I personally had started on medications, you know, my approach is to share with them what I have learned and my concerns, and to discuss with them the process of a taper, what I think it would look like for them, and whether or not it's a possibility. Because the truth is, it's not a possibility for everybody. And that's a pretty stark reality, and something that I didn't discuss with them when I wrote my first prescription for them. You know, I didn't say it may be the case that you have to take this for the rest of your life.
Yes.
And it's not because it's fixing anything. It's because we've created a disturbance that we now can't get out, you know, from underneath. I do use...
Well, that's the basis of the book Prozac Backlash.
Yes.
By Dr. Fitz... what's his name? Fitzmullen, or the guy at Harvard. It's a very famous Harvard professor who first recognized, and this is many, many years after these drugs were introduced, that lo and behold, it's very hard to get off them because they cause physical withdrawal.
Yes, there's a lot of people who have sounded the alarm about this. So Irving Kirsch is a psychologist. Peter Bregan is a psychiatrist. David Healy is a psychiatrist, and others, other professionals, lawyers, and et cetera, you know, who've sort of begun to do either their own research in the case of Irving Kirsch and Dr. Healy, or have just compiled massive amounts of firsthand experience or collective data to suggest that, in fact, we're not correcting anything, and we're creating perturbance, we're creating changes that the body is adapting to, and then we're expecting that the body will readapt if we take a medication away. And that's a tall order, you know, in the case of some people's physiology. So,
By the way, the name of the book is Prozac Backlash, Overcoming the Dangers of Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, and Other Antidepressants. And that book came out, several years ago. The author is, It's Joseph Glenmullen.
Glenmullen, okay, yes. Absolutely.
And he's a physician at Harvard who was one of the first to document this. But as you say, many other doctors have since noted it.
And he talks about, you know, a strategic taper. So this idea of extremely conservative, much more so than anyone was taught in the residency, extremely conservative tapers. And I think acknowledges, as do most people who have experience around tapering patients off of medication, that there's no magic bullet. I mean, my approach these days is to tune someone up from a functional medicine perspective so that they're in the health of their lives before we even touch medication. And my thinking is that that confers some degree of resilience before we really throw this stressor on the body.
Let's focus on that a little more because, people have heard the term of functional medicine and you want to tune people up. But what are some of the considerations when somebody comes in, say, suffering from, I think a good example on the female side might be postpartum depression. That's a common problem. Women feel horrible, immobilized. Tell us about that and what might you be looking for in order to avert reliance on medication in those cases.
Yeah, so it's extremely common, and it's becoming more common for reasons that I probably have a different perspective on than others.
You're alluding to a feminist perspective, or you know what the pressure is put on women, or
concerns about basically environmental and lifestyle factors that I think are largely ignored.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know things like
it's maybe a more modern disease because of our diets and our lifestyles.
For the same reasons that most psychiatric pathology are increasing in prevalence, I don't think it's just, and autism and you name it, other chronic diseases of the past 150 years, I don't think it's better diagnosis necessarily. But yeah, so it's about 10 to 20% of women who will experience this. That's a pretty alarming statistic. And it makes sense to me on a common, you know, common sense, thoughtful level, that women, they're essentially the Achilles heel, would be exposed postpartum because they're donating macro and micronutrients essentially from fats to, you know, to minerals to this baby. And if they're coming into a pregnancy deficient, which most women of course are because they're eating a diet high in sugar and refined carbs and deficient in a lot of macronutrients like natural fats and good protein. Okay, so if they're coming into it deficient, they're donating this whole 9 months, and then they have a sensitivity or a vulnerability around that fluctuation in hormones like stress hormones like cortisol and that feedback loop, and also sex hormones, estrogen and progesterone, then they're going to manifest this syndrome, right? Because that's all it is. We don't really know much more about depression and anxiety other than that it's a collection of symptoms that co-occur, and we certainly can't pretend to know what causes it. And the reason is probably because in different people, different things cause it, right? Like the example, you know, that I learned from a conference way back when is that, you know, your toe can hurt because you have a string wrapped around it, because you hit it with a hammer, because you have an infection, or because somebody's standing on it, right? So like,
but
many
it feels identical, and you'll say,
exactly.
my toe hurts, and it could
exactly.
be, yeah, right.
Exactly. So we have to look at root causes, and so that's where I became, that's where I become a detective, and I, as you are, you know, I look into, you know, is this actually thyroiditis, which is something I see in about 85% of my patients. It's something I also personally dealt with.
What is thyroiditis for our listening audience?
Yeah. So essentially, it's, again, supposed to only occur in about 10% of the population. It's a similar overlap, but a postpartum population. But my belief is that people just aren't screening for it because conventional doctors aren't in the practice of looking for antibodies when they don't have a need to. So it's termed postpartum thyroiditis, but essentially it's a variant ultimately of Hashimoto's or low thyroid function that is secondary to immune system attack of the gland. And there are reasons in postpartum physiology that have to do with immune shifts that women are more vulnerable to autoimmune disorders that are triggered potentially just by the changes of postpartum physiology, but also likely other environmental things that have been on board, like dietary antigens or things as seemingly innocuous as plastics or fluoride. And it's sort of this perfect storm, right? And so they develop this condition. They don't know they have it, but what do they feel? They feel agitated. They have insomnia. They have anxiety. They might lose weight really quickly, like quicker than they might expect. And that might go on for about 1 to 3 months. And then they'll hit, if nothing is done about it, they'll hit the second phase where they look depressed and they feel slowed. They feel, you know, confused or forgetful. They start to gain weight. They start to basically feel blunted, like they should be having more joy than they're otherwise feeling. And there still can be these punctuations of anxiety, sort of amidst that depression. And all of this is all attributable to the hormonal changes related to the thyroid function. And really it's an immune system problem. It's not really a thyroid problem. And so you can end up starting Prozac or Zoloft when really what's going on is endocrine and immune, right? It's not actually related in any way to your serotonin trafficking. And so if you do experience relief from that intervention, it's probably unrelated to its primary action as a medication and related to secondary actions. Like there's some evidence to suggest that actually antidepressants may have something of an anti-inflammatory effect, for example. But the point is there's so many better ways to go about treating that.
Well, yeah, sometimes I use the analogy of, if there's a bad odor in a room, you know, you can go around spraying Lysol in the air and you'll camouflage the odor, but you may not be getting at the underlying cause. So that's in a way, anti-anxiety medications, antidepressants sometimes work that way.
Exactly. So it's working tangentially to what might otherwise resolve the issue and be far better insurance for that patient's future health. And certainly in a nursing mom.
So what do you find nutritionally going on with these women postpartum? What are some of the common problems?
So one of the very common things I see is very low cholesterol. So probably, most...
Well, low cholesterol, isn't that what we're all, badly trying to achieve?
Exactly.
Congratulations, your cholesterol is 110.
Exactly right. So, before I understood the ramifications of this and began to research cell membrane physiology and became sort of almost obsessed with what that meant for mental health, I began to notice this pattern that I would frequently get labs back, and I would just check a fasting lipid panel, a conventional lipid panel, and I would get a total cholesterol back of under 130 most of the time. And so these days when I screen for cholesterol, that's what I'm looking for. Do they have...
You're actually more worried about the low than the high.
Exactly. I'm much more worried about the low. And the reason is because I know, like I said, that they've just gone through this phase to be sort of reductionist about it. They've just gone through this almost 1 year of donating their fats preferentially to the fetus and growing baby, and maybe they're still nursing. And if they're, you and I know that diet is not a primary source of cholesterol, but it is something of a contributor. And so you have to have adequate natural fat intake and cholesterol intake. But you also have to have good synthetic liver function. So your liver actually has to be in a good position to make cholesterol. And so we know that there are a lot of nutrients required to support liver function and antioxidants, amino acids. So this is maybe just evidence that women are in a depleted state globally. And so I start to focus on, how can I use what I know in the psychiatric literature about the risks of low cholesterol being tied, particularly in women, to states of depression, and in men in particular to completed suicide, actually. And this is not, you know, it's not a big leap, again, to understand why this might be. We know that cholesterol is a primary component of cell membranes, which are where all the action is at when it comes to brain health. We know that they're precursors, that cholesterol is a precursor for vitamin D, for sex hormones, and for bile acids. So for getting all the benefit out of what you do eat, all that good stuff that you do eat. So it's a, it plays a critical role, and I treat hormones and I treat the brain. So I think of it as my ally, and I don't like to see low levels. So that certainly would be one pattern I've observed over the years.
So while we're talking about cholesterol, you recently wrote, and you write some very interesting blogs. They're available through your website at kellybroganmd.com, very timely, and you comment on some of the latest happenings in medicine, as I do. And, of course, recently they issued new cholesterol guidelines, and you had a couple of sharply worded sentiments to share about that.
Yeah, I see, and that's even the nice version.
That was probably a clean. That was a cleaned up version.
Exactly right. That was the tempered version. Yeah, I mean, for me, again, I think it comes from this place of really wanting to defend women's right to accurate information and to protect them from what might be a profit-driven agenda on the part of a lot of pharmaceutical companies.
So you have a really women's-oriented perspective on this, because you take the position that women, you know, can be different from men in terms of these broad-based recommendations.
Absolutely, and that's what's borne out. Listen, I am not a cardiologist. I've paid attention to this issue again because I would see my patients coming to me on statins, and I would be concerned for the potential psychiatric ramifications, even if you want to get sort of highbrow about it, of depleting CoQ10, a primary antioxidant for energy production in every single cell. That's something that's very important to me when I see patients who complain of fatigue and forgetfulness, and we're calling it depression, right? So I've paid attention to this issue, and I've been pretty alarmed to learn that, in fact, when it comes to in medicine we refer to as morbidity and mortality, so risk of bad things happening and risk of death, that there is no evidence to support the prescription of statins for this major demographic where they're being broadly recommended. So that's concerning, because if we have no evidence of benefit, then, and we have evidence of harm, including onset of diabetes in postmenopausal women, that's pretty much about the worst thing I want happening to any of my patients, then what are we doing? Broadening by 35 million, you know, citizens, the candidates for this prescription. I think it's harm. I think it's doing harm.
Right. And, you know, examining the evidence on a primary prevention with statins, there's precious little evidence that they offer primary prevention in, quote, healthy women, women without heart disease, or in particular women past a certain age. That threshold may be as young as 65, 70, or 75. And now we're seeing, I mean, it's not uncommon that I see 85-year-old women coming into my office saying, my cardiologist wants me to go on a statin drug. And, you know, why, pray tell?
Yeah, and you know, one of my, as I've alluded to, one of my pet issues personally and professionally, just because I look for it and I see it all the time, is thyroid function. And I, you know, I'm very familiar with the literature that suggests that untreated low thyroid, and that's a whole nother conversation, you know, what does that mean? But untreated low thyroid is actually a quote-unquote cause of hyperlipidemia, of high cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And it's an adaptive mechanism that the body, you know, the body doesn't mess up. That's the thing. Everything it does for a reason. And if you just dig a little deeper, you'll figure out why it's doing what it's doing. It's been exposed to something it doesn't like, or it has some malfunction that it's compensating for. And so I would see, you know, patients I would send to internists, and they would be started on statins when, in fact, I was already, you know, beginning to treat their low thyroid function. And so it's just another way that we can be very, you know, doctors can be very sloppy about the way that they prescribe without doing their due diligence, essentially.
Well, so what are some of the other factors you might look at in a woman who's complaining of depression?
So I think most anybody who treats, you know, sort of mental health endpoints in their practice, who has any degree of knowledge about evidence-based alternative medicine or nutritional medicine is going to be interested in B vitamins. You know, orthomolecular psychiatry has a long history of appreciating the role of B vitamins such as niacin in essentially the treatment and resolution of things as severe as schizophrenia. But in my practice, I look a lot for the primary methylators, we call them. So things like B12 and folate. And then they have sort of a synergistic role with other B vitamins like riboflavin that have a particularly critical enthymine, critical role when it comes to mental health. I mean, even working in the Bellevue emergency room for, you know, almost a decade, we would routinely screen people there for B12 and folate.
Yep.
And this is, you know, these are not holistically oriented folks running that ER. But we know that in critical states of deficiency that a patient can look psychotic and can look catatonically depressed when you're dealing with those B vitamin deficiencies. We know that to be true also with niacin, in a state of something called pellagra, and thiamine, that you can get pretty disturbed when you're dealing with a critical deficiency. But the thing is, there's a whole range, as you know, there's a whole range, right, between optimal and grossly deficient,
so yes.
We can intervene. You know, we can intervene. So I look a lot at B vitamins, and I use activated B vitamins cautiously because they can be big guns, actually, when you just throw them in indiscriminately. But if you use them cautiously, you can, you know, turn around countless cases of what otherwise might be labeled as depression or anxiety.
Well, this actually, I mean, as a psychiatrist, you know that there is a psychiatric medication.
It's yes.
in the PDR, the physician's desk reference.
Yes.
But it's actually methylfolate. It's an
exactly
activated
right.
form of folic acid. It goes under a brand name Deplin.
Yes.
Tell us about why that might help patients with depression.
Yes. So PAM Lab has actually done a fair number of studies looking at Deplin as an augmentation strategy so you would start it after an antidepressant hasn't really worked.
I call it the hamburger helper for your antidepressant.
Right. It's sort of like, what's plan B here? So you would start it as a, you know, sort of like a plan B, or you would start it right up front with the antidepressant to induce more rapid remission. You know, my approach is, why not just start something like that by itself? But of course, you can also personalize, and they don't recommend this because they want to capture the largest audience, of course, but you can personalize the relevance of this intervention because you can test very easily at most labs, and most of the time it's actually covered by insurance, for a gene variant that, you know, something you're born with called MTHFR.
Wait, this is a family program. You can't use language like that.
Right? It's an unfortunate acronym.
Let's say it again. It's MTHFR.
Got
That's
it.
A blood test that will tell you. It has something to do with homocysteine, right? Maybe you can explain
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So most of the time it's been employed as an important, appreciable risk factor for cardiovascular health, because when you have this variant, and there are many different versions you can have ranging from like not a big deal to a big deal, when you have this variant, you're not going to do a good job at converting this B vitamin folate into a form that your brain and central nervous system can use, but also a form that you can use to reduce inflammatory compounds like homocysteine. And it's just part of this big cycle called the one carbon cycle that, you know, needs to flow, and it's not going to flow well if you don't have adequate B12 in an activated form and you don't have this active folate. So it would be, in my opinion, sort of irresponsible to prescribe it without B12. And it's not just my opinion. Actually, most experts would agree with that. Or to prescribe it at the dosage that is used pharmaceutically. So, for example, Deplin is actually, they're taking this dosage, and they have already off the market, marketed in 7.5 milligrams and 15 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually considered quite a high dose, and you can get results in the microgram range to the 1 to 3 milligram range.
Right. And those are available through over-the-counter.
As
nutritional supplements. We have some of those in our dispensary.
Exactly.
So you don't necessarily have to get it as a pharmacy drug, which, by the way, it's often not covered by copays and can be extraordinarily expensive. So
yes, yeah. And it's very expensive. And also, you know, if you really want to be picky, which I am about these sorts of things, it has unnecessary dyes and preservatives in it that you wouldn't otherwise want. It's a blue pill you wouldn't otherwise want to be exposed to.
Why do they do that? You know, they take, they take Paradise and put in a parking lot. I'm not sure why they, you know, it's just a natural vitamin. Why do they have to put in all kinds of phony colorations and bizarre sounding ingredients to make a pill? They could just make it into a nondescript, natural capsule.
It's just sort of what they know, I think. Yeah. I mean, I think of Centrum as being one of the most toxic things, you know, like a multivitamin, as being one of the most toxic things you could do for your health. And I'm sure a lot of people go to the drugstore and they think, oh, yeah, it's probably a good idea to take a multivitamin. And they pick up this pharmaceutically created, you know, concoction, and it's full. I mean, if you look at the ingredient list on that, it's nothing you'd ever want passing your life.
Yellow number, whatever, and red number.
Exactly,
blue number, tartrazine, whatever. So those are some of the things that you might look at in addressing depression. What about essential fatty acids? That, I think, should be an important part of the arsenal of every psychiatrist. Unfortunately, as you know, it's not.
Yes, absolutely. And I think I see that because most of my friends are conventional psychiatrists, and I, you know, in New York, this isn't Portland, Oregon, or California. You know, most of the time, we have a pretty small community of integrative doctors that we're talking to. So I see that omega-3 fatty acids in a fish oil form is trickling down into the general awareness of the average practitioner, even somebody who's not otherwise, you know, sort of keen on these things.
Right. So they may say, well, here's your Lexapro.
Exactly.
But also take a couple of fish oil capsules daily.
Yes. And so I am, you know, I'm generally very skeptical about nutrition-related research and supplement-related research because I'm never just recommending, as you know, I don't know, I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but I'm never just recommending one supplement or even a handful of supplements without lifestyle change. All of my patients are going to be radically changing their diet when they walk through my door. All of my patients are going to be engaging in health-promoting activities, exercise, and meditation, relaxation response. So there's never just going to be one thing I'm throwing at it. And in these studies where they look at efficacy, of which there are many, by the way, surprisingly, efficacy of, let's say, omega-3 fish oil, they're not asking patients to do any of those things.
Right.
So all they're doing is
so if you got, you know, a schlumpy person sitting around smoking cigarettes, eating a horrendous diet, and you give them a couple of fish oil pills, you're stacking the deck against the success of the fish oil pills for sure.
You do. And you are. And so even if you do see a benefit, it may be because, you know, promoting the availability of these anti-inflammatory fats that are, again, important for cell membrane fluidity, maybe the reason it's helping is because that person is eating a lot of hydrogenated oils and trans fats that have totally messed up their membranes, and this is a good crutch. This is a good compensation. I actually work with a full spectrum of fatty acids, so I'm interested not just in fish oil, but also in evening primrose, like GLA or anti-inflammatory omega-6. I'm interested in other.
Yeah, discuss the role of primrose oil, or I guess there are other forms, black currant seed oil, or borage oil,
because
they seem to play a specific role in women's health. They've been touted as being helpful for PMS and for mood problems in women, but they're omega-6 fatty acids, and that's, you know, and a lot of people are suspicious of, you know, it's like they simplify it and say omega-3 good, omega-6 bad.
Exactly. And until I started to really better appreciate this, the physiology and the cascade of omega-3 and omega-6 fats in the body, I didn't understand what the problem would be with long-term high-dose fish oil. And so when you start to understand the relationship between these two classes of fats, you see that they need to work in balance together, because otherwise you can suppress what is an equally important anti-inflammatory omega-6. And it's important particularly for autoimmune disorders, which is, again, something that I see a lot in my practice. And there is a small literature suggesting that it's important for progesterone receptor sensitization, for hormone-related pathologies like PMS.
Yep.
And there, you know, the reason that we've demonized omega-6s is because we know that trans fats and hydrogenated oils come from, for the most part, are coming from vegetable oils that are man-made and that didn't exist in our diet, you know, about 150 years ago.
Cottonseed oil and
exactly.
Whatnot.
If you look up, you know, you can Google sort of an image of how vegetable oil is made, and you'll see this elaborate graph of like all of the, you know, deodorizing and bleaching and all of the processing that it goes through to render it quote unquote edible. It's pretty clear that it doesn't belong in our bodies. But there are actually other fatty acids that are important as well, and those are called phospholipids, that have a good literature, of course, not much in psychiatry, but if we're looking more globally, like, you know, chronic fatigue and other mitochondrial disorders, and those have names like phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylserine, phosphatidylethanolamine, phosphatidylinositol, and they are also important players. I'm also a big proponent of the role of saturated fat in women's mental health. Well, I think it's probably mental health in general, but that's my focus. And that's something we've absolutely been taught should be avoided at all costs.
Right. So the diet that you favor is not the raw foods vegan diet, but actually more like a paleo diet.
Exactly. So I did not come to this out of personal preference. In my heart of hearts, I think I'm probably a vegan. I struggle a lot ethically, and did even before I knew anything about nutrition, with how to interface with eating animals. And I think that actually, you know, I came to this because I wanted to know what is the diet that actually promotes the most blood sugar balance, which is a critical factor when it comes to psychiatric symptoms. Okay, so the most blood sugar balance and the most access to the fats that our brain, which is 60% lipid, needs to function. And so, you know, there are a number of clinicians who care about these same issues and have all sort of come to the conclusion that when you control for things like grains, you control for sugar, and maybe in some cases you also control for processed dairy, that you can achieve like clinically miraculous results. And it's an extension of what's been used therapeutically in neurology, and even in brain cancer, which is a ketogenic diet. So giving the brain like exactly the type of fuel that it wants, which is actually fat.
or even simply stabilizing blood sugar, because we see so many patients who have anxiety and irritability, mood fluctuations. And, you know, it was our predecessor, Carlton Fredericks, you know, maybe 50 years ago, who first pointed that out. He wrote a book, you know, Hypoglycemia and You. And he listed not just physical problems, but a lot of mental and psychiatric problems as being the result of simply low blood sugar, which is a reaction to refined carbohydrates, you know, the roller coaster that people undergo every day because their blood sugar is all over the place.
Exactly. And it can look even like bipolar disorder. I mean, it can be so severe that you wouldn't ever think it could be attributed to dietary sensitivity to sugar.
Yeah. Remarkable. So that's certainly a factor. You also pay attention to, you know, the critical prenatal period. You talk to women about what they can do to assure a healthy pregnancy. What are some of the inputs there?
Yes. So that's actually my favorite type of patient to meet, because I have the potential to, you know, to lead them into a realm of health management and to escort them into really a transformation about how they're thinking about medical interventions, how they're thinking about their environment at a very critical window. I also like to think that I am relatively good at helping people to conceive when they've been told that they're otherwise unable to. And for the most part, I do this by controlling for inflammatory elements of diet like gluten and grains, as well as, you know, in some people, dairy, and also by upping their fat intake, because the body is not going to allow for conception if it doesn't perceive that its most critical nutrient, which is fat, is available. And when I'm talking about fat, I hope it's clear that I'm not talking about, like, you know, Twinkies and pork rinds. I'm talking about naturally occurring fats in, you know, fish, meat, eggs.
Avocados and so on.
Yeah, avocados, nuts and seeds, coconut oil, butter, that sort of thing. But I also think it's a critical time to start to think about what might come ahead. I mean, it was probably not surprising, but I advocate for patients to work with midwives. I'm a big home birth advocate. Most of my patients, the vast majority, actually work with OBs, with MDs, in the city. And there are a lot of different ways that they're going to be interfacing with non-evidence-based medicine and obstetrics that I think that I'm not going to tell people what to do. That's not what I'm here for. But I want to help them to feel empowered to think critically about what is recommended to them. And in the end, that's, you know, as a parent, you know, as soon to be parent, that's, in these days, it's a very important part of, the parenting journey is knowing how to make your own decisions as a parent.
It's certainly a teachable moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So.
So if patients were to go to kellybroganmd.com, what's hot on your website currently? What are you working on?
So to that end, I actually am the medical director of a relatively new project called Fearless Parent, where we're looking to help women and parents who are either thinking about conceiving, are pregnant, or have, you know, young children, to help them navigate, sort of cut through the crap, you know, and navigate all that they're being told, understand where they fit in, you know, between sort of like the hippies and herbal remedies, but also like the serious white coat doctors and their recommendations. So we're really looking to create a dialogue around examination of these issues and help people to think for themselves. And I am blogging pretty actively for a couple of different sources just about looking at mental illness through a different lens. And what are the things to think about before you see a psychiatrist, before you ask for that prescription? What are the very modifiable at-home things that you can do to change, whether it's through your diet or simple vitamin tests or deficiencies that you can ask your doctor to run? So my agenda is really to move psychiatry into a much more sophisticated role. I share this agenda with the director of the NIMH, who also is very concerned about the direction that psychiatry is
taking. The National Institute of Mental Health.
Yeah, Dr. Inzel.
Concerned that people are getting too much in the way of psychiatric drugs, ironically.
Yeah, and he's concerned that our diagnostic strategies are not validated. And then, in fact, it's, you know, our diagnostic manual is more like a dictionary with a bunch of labels in it that experts have agreed on. It's not in any way, you know, you could argue with other branches of medicine as well and their evidence base, but we don't even have that where we can look at a diagnostic strategy for depression. It's just basically someone's impression, and you catch them on a day where they're feeling, you know, either feeling generous with their prescription pad versus not, and your diagnosis is one thing versus another. It just shouldn't be that way, let alone that these people are not checking for very simple things that are in the literature as being causes of mental illness, like B12 deficiency, for example.
Well, you are certainly a welcome addition to the psychiatric scene and the women's health scene, and you're making a great contribution, and congratulations. Your website is aesthetic and informative, kellybroganmd.com. And Kelly, you also see patients here in New York City,
yes.
We broadcast from. Your office located in Midtown, correct?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's a total pleasure to speak with a like-minded provider. I mean, it's seemingly, you know, impossible to connect with people who get it. And so I'm really, really pleased to connect and to be here. Thanks.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Okay, our guest, Kelly Brogan, MD. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.